Strange studies of strange stories.
It was a warm summer evening, and Klausner walked quickly through the front gate and around the side of the house and into the garden at the back. He went on down the garden until he came to a wooden shed, and he unlocked the door, went inside, and closed the door behind him. The interior of the shed was an unpainted room. Against one wall, on the left, there was a long wooden workbench, and on it, among a littering of wires and batteries and small sharp tools, there stood a black box about 3 feet long, the shape of a child's coffin. Klausner moved across the room to the box. The top of the box was open, and he bent down and began to poke and peer inside it among a mass of different colored wires and silver tubes. He picked up a piece of paper that lay beside the box, studied it carefully, put it down, peered inside the box, and started running his fingers along the wires, tugging gently at them to test the connections, glancing back at the paper, then into the box, then at the paper again, checking each wire. He did this for perhaps an hour.
The shape of a child's coffin? Dahl is not messing around here.
It's efficient writing. I certainly saw this box in my mind immediately when he described it that way. It's funny, I said on our first episode of the month that there was an undercurrent of cruelty in Roald Dahl's writing. And Jamie Britton commented on that episode. I would say that rather being an undercurrent of cruelty in Dahl's work, there is very much an overcurrent or tidal wave. It just made me laugh. I have to use more overcurrents in my writing, you know, really get the point across. What is this story?
This is The Sound Machine, a short story by Roald Dahl, not to be confused with Miami Sound Machine, which was a late 70s, early 80s pop sensation featuring Gloria Estefan. And I needed to get that out of the way so folks weren't disappointed by what we were covering on the show, because I know that's where my mind would have went right away.
I knew your mind was going to go there when I found the story. I had a gym teacher who would play Bad Boy by Miami Sound Machine while we did calisthenics in gym class. Like, you naughty, bad, 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 bad boy. You make me feel so good. And then there's just children doing jumping jacks. It's a weird scene. But because I don't want people to be disappointed, I'm going to reveal other facts about Gloria Estefan and Miami Sound Machine throughout the episode. Other facts like the one I just revealed. Allow me to introduce myself. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. You are listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories here on Patreon. Who is that reader?
Why, that was Ryan Fahey making his first appearance on the podcast. Hmm. He's something of a sound machine himself. He does regular readings for LibriVox, covering short stories, biographies, and histories. So check out the list. It's lots of cool history stuff.
Thank you, Ryan.
One of my favorite things about the future that we live in is that I can casually consume history, like watching those little snippets on YouTube or breakdowns of Roman Empire stuff.
Yeah.
When you go to school, you know, there's going to be a test, so you have to like shove it in your brain so you can spit it out later. Yeah. But now you can just kind of get context, get the gist of it. You don't have to remember for later.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, because we have this whole thing called the internet, which is a repository of all human knowledge available at our fingertips. So who needs to remember anything?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, here's a fact. Speaking of facts, Anything for You by Miami Sound Machine. Great song. Very emotional. Not good for slow dancing. Cleared the floor at my freshman homecoming dance. Oof. It's about a breakup.
Ah.
My gym teacher must have been DJing.
How about some facts about this story by Roald Dahl? It was first published in The New Yorker in September of 1949.
And it was recommended by our listener, Billy Launder. We weren't really sure which stories to fill out the month with. Roald Dahl's got a lot of short stories, but Billy left this comment on Lamb to the Slaughter. A friend got me into Dahl's short stories when I was 11 years old. I'd always found his children's stories too disturbing, as they never acknowledged the horror that was front and center. An overcurrent, I think, is what he's searching for there.
Yes.
The witches, the twits, George's marvelous medicine. Bludgeoning someone to death with the frozen leg of lamb was fairly tame in comparison to those, I thought. I really hope you guys check out The Sound Machine, which is Dahl's stab at cosmic horror. Mm. So I had to check that out. And it is indeed something like, I would say, Roald Dahl's From Beyond.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what I thought.
He could easily have come up with this concept independent of that Lovecraft story, but I did wonder, maybe he read it.
It's possible.
I don't know how popular that story was at the time in the 50s, but let's go ahead and get into the story.
Our story begins with this guy, Klausner, and he is building something in his work shed.
Kate Sherrod of Pulp Sonnets fame,
yes.
She shared a video with us on Twitter of Roald Dahl's actual writing shed, which is pretty much just like this work shed is described. So I'll put that link in the show notes, but it was from a BBC interview in 1982. He's saying, I can't possibly work in the house. It's too noisy. There's kids. There's things going on. So he walks them out to the little shed in his garden. He hasn't cleaned it in like a decade, he says. So it's a little grody in there. But that kind of thing's like catnip to me, to see people's workspaces and their offices and their little libraries. So it was cool to watch that video. This fella, Klausner, is in his workspace fooling around with this coffin box of wires, talking to himself, messing with some dials. He's saying, now this one, yes. But is this right? Where's my diagram? Ah, yes, of course. So he's lost in his work.
Yes. And as he works, a tall guy just walks in into the shed, and it's Scott, the doctor. And I think it's important that he's not called Dr. Scott. He's called Scott the doctor, which to me says he's either a physician or a psychiatrist.
Yeah, I think he is. Right. And there's a level of, he calls him Scott, so he knows him well enough because he's his neighbor. Mm-hmm. But he's not going to call him Dr. Scott. Dr. Scott.
Now, Dr. Scott says that he came down to check on Klausner, and he wasn't in the house, so he had a look around for him. He asked Klausner about his throat, to which Klausner says, I'm fine.
Oh, now I'm here, I might as well have a look at it, he says. Please don't trouble. I'm quite cured. I'm fine. So do you think he actually had complained to Dr. Scott? Or is this Dr. Scott coming in with a flimsy excuse to be nosy?
Well, I wonder if Klausner isn't maybe some kind of patient who has emotional problems or mental health problems, and he's coming in and checking on him.
Interesting.
Because that's what he does. And a lot of times, especially back in the 50s, doctors did both. You wouldn't typically have just a psychiatrist or a psychologist that would do this. Your GP would do all of it.
Right.
I feel like maybe that is maybe what's going on.
I thought maybe because we don't really know what his situation is, since he's only out in the garden and the workshed. Yeah. Is he getting away from a family inside? Is there do people live with him who have said, hey, doc, yeah, he's got a little throat problem. I wish you'd come over here and have a look at it. Mm-hmm. And what they're really worried about is what he's doing back there.
Sure. That made me think of that Tom Waits song.
Yeah, me too.
What's he building in there? There's some tension in the room, and Scott points out that Klausner is still wearing his hat, which Klausner didn't even notice. He had his hat on from being outside. Mm-hmm. Scott asks if he's making a radio, but Klausner says, no, I'm just fooling around.
I can relate to that specific tension, though. Like, if you're working on something and you didn't want to be disturbed when someone just wanders into it.
Yeah.
This thing I'm working on is half finished. Don't look at it. Somebody looking over your shoulder or, you know, whatever it is. Please, no.
It's like, I'm busy. Go away.
Yeah.
I didn't ask for you to show up. Now, Klausner says it has to do with sound.
Good heavens, man. Don't you get enough of that sort of thing all day in your work? I like sound, Klausner says. So it seems. And so apparently, we think Klausner has some kind of actual job in sound as well.
Yeah.
This is a project they'd probably frown on at work, though. So he's got to be doing it at home. I was thinking, this is like the setup for a Spider-Man villain.
It is.
They don't believe in my work, but my sonic ray, I'll develop it in the garden.
Didn't Shocker use vibrations? Was it all his thing about sending out vibrations? I think it was.
Yeah.
The doctor says that he's going to leave now, but he doesn't. He just keeps looking at this thing Klausner's building. And Klausner can see the doctor is very interested, so he explains.
All right, I'll tell you if you're interested.
The theory is very simple, really. The human ear, you know that it can't hear everything. There are sounds that are so low-pitched or so high-pitched that it can't hear them.
Yes, the doctor said. Yes.
Well, speaking very roughly, any note so high that it has more than 15,000 vibrations a second, we can't hear it. Dogs have better ears than us. You know you can buy a whistle whose note is so high-pitched that you can't hear it at all, but a dog can hear it.
Yes, I've seen one, the doctor said.
Of course you have, and up the scale, higher than the note of that whistle, there is another note. A vibration, if you like, but I prefer to think of it as a note. You can't hear that one either. And above that, there is another and another rising right up the scale forever and ever and ever. An endless succession of notes, an infinity of notes. There is a note, if only our ears could hear it, so high that it vibrates a million times a second, and another a million times as high as that. And on, higher and higher as far as numbers go, which is infinity, eternity, beyond the stars.
Like you said at the top, it's almost like From Beyond, the resonator, but with sound.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. High concept stuff for the time. We do have ultrasonic listening devices now.
Sure.
That are used in all sorts of ways and are constantly being upgraded and modified. People are questing for those sounds and trying to figure out, you know, what they are. I remember I was watching something where they were tickling mice recording them while being tickled and finding out that if they pitched that down, that those mice were giggling as they were being tickled, but we just can't hear it. Uh-huh. It's still a growing technology. And so he's produced something pretty advanced here.
The story explains how frail and sickly and just kind of weird Klausner is. It almost seems that the doctor pities him.
Horrible beyond conception was the change which had taken place in my best friend Crawford Tillinghast.
Klausner goes on to explain his device. I believe that there is a whole world of sound about us all the time that we cannot hear. It is possible that up there in those high-pitched, inaudible regions, there is a new, exciting music being made with subtle harmonies and fierce, grinding discords. A music so powerful that it would drive us mad if only our ears were tuned to hear the sound of it. There may be anything. So at that point, the doctor interrupts him, just goes, look, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, he says it's not very probable.
Now, Klausner says, why not? There are lots of sounds out there. In fact, he's already made a detector with a needle so that he knows that there are sounds out there, but he actually wants to be able to hear the sounds, and that's what this new device is for. Klausner explains that it will lower the pitch of sounds into something audible if it works.
He says, like a bat, you know, they use the sonar and they're squeaking. If I want to hear that, I can record it. If I know that the bat's doing it, pitch it down. The bat would sound like it's a witness on a true crime show whose identity is being disguised.
Now, he's going to test the machine this evening, and the doctor wishes him good luck and says he'll be back to check on his progress and then finally leaves. After putting some more work and fiddling with the device, he comically fumbles with it, taking it outside and putting on some headphones to listen.
It's a little bit of character work. You know, he's the absent-minded professor archetype, sort of the dad from Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, exactly. Now, he stood there in the garden beside the wooden table, so pale, small, and thin that he looked like an ancient, consumptive, bespectacled child. Pretty mean.
Yeah, maybe not like the dad in Beauty and the Beast.
Now, the sun is setting, and he's listening and fiddling with a dial, and then he hears a shriek, a frightful, piercing shriek. He looks around, and he only sees a woman next door. She's cutting some flowers and putting them in a basket, and he hears the noise again. A throatless, inhuman shriek, sharp and short, very clear and cold. The note itself possessed a minor, metallic quality that he had never heard before. Klausner looks around trying to figure out where the sound is coming from, but then he quickly sees, when he hears the sound, it is as she's cutting the flowers. So he thinks, is it connected to the flowers? Are the flowers screaming? So he calls to her, Mrs. Saunders. And I figure he's going to say, stop doing that. The flowers are screaming. Don't cut them. But no, he says, actually, go ahead and cut one now.
Right. Well, he's got to make sure this is indeed what he's hearing. He's a scientist. Yes.
Of course. She's trying to figure out what's up with them, like why he's telling her to cut flowers and stuff. And she wonders maybe if she should get her husband, but he's pretty harmless. So she humors him and she cuts. And the shriek rings out in his headphones again. And then he asks her to stop. He tells her that the flowers are screaming when she cuts them. It's too high-pitched, but he can hear them with his headphones. And she smiles and nods and leaves.
He gives her no context. He just says, you have, with a sharp pair of scissors, cut through the stems of living things. And each rose that you cut screamed in the most terrible way. Did you know that, Mrs. Saunders? I heard them shrieking. Each time you cut one, I heard the cry of pain, a very high-pitched sound. Approximately 132,000 vibrations a second. You couldn't have possibly heard it yourself, but I heard it. Did you really, Mr. Klausner? Backing away. I think that there is this clever from beyond concept in the background, but really what Roald Dahl is interested in is actually the way this obsessive man looks to the outside world, the sort of social component. And there's a bit of change in tone in the story here where we sense, oh, that's really what he's sort of focusing on. But not before he does one more cool push on the concept. He says, you might say that a rose bush has no nervous system to feel with, no throat to cry with. You'd be right. It hasn't. Not like ours, anyway. But how do you know, Mrs. Saunders? How do you know that a rose bush doesn't feel as much pain when someone cuts its stem in two as you would feel if someone cut your wrist off with garden shears? How do you know that? It's alive, isn't it? That's what creeps her out, and she splits, because he just referenced cutting her
hands off
garden shears.
Yeah.
It's true. Plants are everything Lovecraftian. You know, they're this odd intelligence that coexists with us, but it doesn't perceive the world the same way as we do. It has a different scope of time than we do. It doesn't regard us as the center of the universe at all, if it regards us at all. And it's different from anything else. You know, we're just the same as the furniture in the room.
Intelligence, I think, is a strong word to use. I don't think plants are particularly intelligent. They're able to react to their environment and do different things. But having any kind of concept or idea of self, I don't think that they have.
We don't know, but yeah. I think I understand what you're saying, that we can describe it as certain reaction to stimulus. It comes down to operational definitions of what intelligence means. Yeah. I had plants that moved that creeped me out. I've talked about them on the show before, where they would close up and open over the course of the day. So sometimes I felt like I'd catch them out of the corner of my eye. Learning about mushrooms and those networks underneath the ground, like that trees feed their young. I didn't really ever think about that. That some trees, I thought they were more like sailors in the port where they just kind of dropped. They didn't really care where they had children. But then if they have an abundance of nutrition, they'll, through those networks, feed their offspring.
Mycorrhizal networks is what it's called. And it uses the fungus. Fungus connects these plants together. Without the fungus that's underneath there, they're able to not only send nutrients and water and other things back and forth, they're able to communicate. And specifically, I was like, well, what do they say to each other? Well, one of the things is that there are aphid repellents that plants can emit when aphids start attacking them, these bugs. And what they'll do, or what they've found, when the aphids come and attack a tree and start eating it, messing it up, the trees around it will somehow know, even though they're not being touched, it's through this network that's underneath them.
Right.
And they start letting out this stuff that not only does it repel the aphids, it calls in wasps. They like the smell of it. And the wasps come in, they eat aphids. So it's like a double whammy of defense.
So they get on the horn and they call it. Well, so you don't think that's intelligence?
No, no. It's just it's a reaction. It's like just a natural. I don't think that there's a thought like, it's aphids. I better do A, B, and C. It's just aphids come. There's some chemical in the aphid or some way that it attacks it, that it triggers a response, that response says, do this, go here, do that. Maybe a very limited intelligence.
I think that trees are just as capable as humans into tricking themselves into thinking they have free will. Because everything you're describing, I don't know, I could perhaps describe humanity the same way. So
we could argue the definition of intelligence for quite some time, but we're not. We're going to continue talking about this story.
Well, this is why it's a good story, right? Because it does provoke this kind of thing. Even if it's meant to be to comedic effect, you're left thinking about it.
Klausner goes over to a daisy and he bends the stem slightly, listening to see when it makes noise. And it says, from the moment he started pulling to the moment when the stem broke, he distinctly heard in the earphones a faint, high-pitched cry, curiously inanimate.
He took another daisy and did it again. Once more he heard the cry, but he wasn't sure now that it expressed pain. No, it wasn't pain. It was surprise. Or was it? It didn't really express any of the feelings or emotions known to a human being. It was just a cry, a neutral, stony cry, a single emotionless note expressing nothing. It had been the same with the roses. He had been wrong in calling it a cry of pain. A flower probably didn't feel pain. It felt something else, which we didn't know about. Something called Tom, or Spun, or Plinigment, or anything you like.
So if it's not a cry of pain, then what is it? Is this just another thing that is beyond our understanding?
But without knowing that fact about the wasps, I had written down in my notes, maybe it's a communication to insects. Come and get it before it's gone, if there's going to be some pollination that happens. So when they fall off, this is going to decay in a second. So this is when, get it while it's hot. Come on, shake your body, baby. Do that conga. I know you can't control yourself any longer. Some kind of thing like that.
Yeah, I get it now. The next morning, Klausner goes to the park with his listening device and gets an axe and finds a tree. He cuts into the tree and he hears a different sound. A harsh, noteless, enormous noise. A growling, low-pitched, screaming sound. Not quick and short like the noises of the roses, but drawn out like a sob lasting for fully a minute. Loudest at the moment when the axe struck, fading gradually fainter and fainter until it was gone. This actually makes Klausner feel bad, and he apologizes to the tree. He runs back home, calls Dr. Scott. He tells him to come over as soon as possible. The doctor asks if he's sick. Klausner says he can't explain what's going on. He's getting upset, so the doctor agrees to come over despite not wanting to get out of bed.
It's 6:30 in the morning.
So Klausner sits waiting by the phone, and he begins to spiral a bit. He thinks of all of the blades of grass that are cut, and of food.
500 wheat plants screaming together, and every second another 500 being cut and screaming. And no, he thought, I do not want to go to a wheat field with my machine.
He thinks apples would be fine. They drop off naturally, but vegetables, and potatoes, the humanity.
Oh, just yanking him out of the ground. Ah!
So Dr. Scott shows up at the house, and Klauster quickly takes him to the park. He explains he wanted a tree, but he didn't have any at his house, so that's why he's come out with the axe to the park. The doctor is very skeptical of this, but he puts on the headphones anyway when prompted, humoring Klausner.
And he's got his whole coffin box set up. He says, "Listen carefully and tell me afterwards precisely what you hear. I want to make quite sure."
So Dr. Scott says he hears a humming noise, which means the machine's working. Klausner picks up the axe, but he's hesitant to hit the tree again because he feels bad. Finally, he does. But as he does, a branch from the tree falls down, lands on the machine, and destroys it.
Oh, no. Was the tree defending itself?
He asks Scott if he heard it, but Scott's not sure. "I don't know what I heard. Probably the noise of the branch breaking." He was speaking rapidly, rather irritably. "What did it sound like?" Klausner leaned forward slightly, staring hard at the doctor. "Exactly what did it sound like?" "Oh, hell," the doctor said. "I really don't know. I was more interested in getting out of the way. Let's leave it." The two of them just awkwardly stare at each other after that. Klausner then asks if Scott can stitch up the tree, you know, the wound that was made in there. But the doctor says, "I don't stitch wood."
Right.
It's ridiculous. Then Klausner says, "Maybe you've got some iodine." The doctor says, "I do." You can see that the doctor is now humoring him, and he treats the tree's injury.
Honestly, I thought that Klausner really did develop this machine and was hearing things. And But at this point, I'm going, well, he's a scientist, you know. He would understand that stitching up a tree and iodine, rubbing iodine into wood isn't going to do anything.
Yeah.
And he's so insistent the doc is treating him like a crazy person because he's holding an axe.
Yeah.
He says, "You do as I say, stitch it up." Klausner was gripping the axe handle, and he spoke softly in a curious, almost a threatening tone. Yeah. "Don't be silly," the doctor said. "I can't stitch through wood." "Then paint the cut with iodine. It'll sting, but that can't be helped." "Now look," the doctor said. "Let's not be ridiculous. Paint the cut with iodine." He saw Klausner's hands tightening on the handle of the axe. He decided that his only alternative was to run away fast, and he certainly wasn't going to do that. "Okay, I'll paint it with iodine." So there's this, what's the word? Overcurrent of menace that comes in here that is making him do that. He went up to the tree trunk, uncorked the bottle, tipped some of the iodine on cotton wool. You know, he's really making a show of it.
Yeah.
And kept one eye on Klausner, who was standing motionless with the axe in his hands, watching him. "Make sure you get it right in." "Yes," the doctor said.
"There you are," he said. "It's done." He straightened up and surveyed his work in a very serious manner. "That should do nicely." Klausner came closer and gravely examined the two wounds. "Yes," he said, nodding his huge head slowly up and down. "Yes, that will do nicely." He stepped back a pace. "You'll come and look at them again tomorrow." "Oh, yes," the doctor said. "Of course. And put some more iodine on." "If necessary, yes." "Thank you, doctor," Klausner said. And he nodded his head again, and he dropped the axe, and all at once he smiled. A wild, excited smile. And quickly the doctor went over to him, and gently he took him by the arm, and he said, "Come on, we must go now." And suddenly they were walking away, the two of them, walking silently, rather hurriedly across the park, over the road, back to the house.
And that's the end of the story. We never get a check on the veracity of the machine. It's possible it's just a box with a bunch of loose wires in it, like that old robot you built.
Yes.
Do you think he's crazy or that the machine drove him crazy?
Yes, I don't know. I think that's kind of what's cool about the story. You could look at it either way. It could be that he was already mentally unwell and this doctor was just always checking on him, and this obsession kind of overtook him and drove him a little more nuts, and then he kind of went back to normal after this whole thing happened where the doctor patched up the tree and everything. Or, like you suggested, hearing all of these screaming plants, it freaked him out to the point that he had a mental breakdown, and that's what happened. But it seems a little odd that the doctor is visiting him, and I mean, maybe he's just a friend, but I don't get the impression that they're friends. It seems like he's there kind of checking in on him and not just the throat, and I'm not exactly sure what makes me think that, but that's the feeling I got. Maybe he has a history of being unwell mentally.
This definitely seems like something a crazy person might do.
Sure.
Build a machine to justify some kind of obsessive need to tear away from everybody else. Yeah, I thought it was a cool story.
Yeah.
It indeed was a stab at cosmic horror and then had a funny hook to it. I do want to point out that we're going to do the automatic grammatizator next week.
Yeah.
Which should prompt all kinds of interesting discussion. I do want to point out that there was kind of a Werby story that we're not doing called Royal Jelly.
Oh, Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, I didn't think it was strange enough for us to do, but it is a beekeeper, one of our favorite kind of characters,
yeah,
who's feeding his underweight infant daughter royal jelly from hives.
Oh, wow.
And she gets fat and white, like some gigantic grub that was approaching the end of its larval life. And I think he's eating it, too. I think they're both turning into bees of some sort. We're not doing that one, but no, that is the kind of thing that it sounds like we would do. Also, I was surprised he wrote the story Man from the South, which I recognized. It's the one where there's the wager, an older gentleman bets a young American. He can't spark his lighter 10 times straight.
All right, yeah.
If the American wins, he gets a Cadillac. If not, he'll have his left pinky removed.
Was that a Twilight Zone?
It was an Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
That's what I was thinking.
And then they did it again in the 80s. They did a remake of it, which is when I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had that twist at the end where, you know, the gentleman's traveling companion comes in and says, stops the bet. I already lost all my possessions and proves it. It only had one finger on it and a thumb. So there's a ironic twist at the end. I didn't realize it was a Roald Dahl story.
I didn't either.
Quentin Tarantino did it in that movie Four Rooms as well.
I do remember that.
Anyway, on this one, I think at the end of the day, the story is just really about if you develop an ultrasonic listening device, the rhythm is going to get you. That's what I learned.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I want to thank our reader, Ryan Fahey.
Yes.
He does some readings on Liverbox, short stories, biographies, histories. Go check him out. Find his stuff. It is good.
We'll link out in the show notes. You give some of that a listen. I also want to thank our patrons. Got a few I want to name right now, and I'm going to start by thanking Christian Oldholm.
I'd like to thank Jeff Zonin.
Cameron Lee, thank you.
David Halstead, thank you.
Tiago Salvador Souza, thank you so much.
Hey, Richard Sullivan, thank you.
Testy Testerson, thank you.
Thanks to Timothy Clark.
Ray Hinojosa, thank you.
And lastly, Aaron Vaughn, thank you.
We'll be back next week with some more Dahl. Until then, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.